Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast is titled Future Global Food Production. Recorded in 1993, this episode features Dr. Norman Borlaug, 1970 Nobel Peace Prize winner and founder of the International Wheat and Maize Institute, Dr. Matthew McMahon of the World Bank's Latin America Division, and Dr. Robert Chandler Jr., founding director emeritus of the International Rice Research Institute, discussing the future of global food production. We hope you enjoy today's episode, and don't forget to subscribe to the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
Well, it's real nice to have two longtime colleagues and friends here to sit down informally and discuss some of the problems in food production, in agriculture, if you will, because 98% of our total world food production comes from the land, be it crop production or be it animal production, and only more than 1% from the ocean and inland waters. We've got 5.5 billion people on the planet Earth at the present time, and the outlooks is for probably 9 billion or so by 1920 or 2023, somewhere in there. Nobody knows for sure. But what about the land situation that produces this? How much additional land is there in different parts of the world that can be brought under cultivation with new technology? And in those areas of the world where the amount of new land, that there's no more new land available, what do you do there in changing yield? And how does this all wash out from the standpoint of world food needs in the next, next 3 decades, 4 decades?
One of the things that bothers me, Norm, is that looking at rice, which is the crop I know the most about, is that the amount of land area devoted to rice in India, for example, which is the second largest producer of rice in the world and also the second largest nation in the world, leveled off in 1977. And there's been no significant change from that day till this in the amount of land cultivated. So the increased production had to come from improved varieties, from the use of more fertilizer, from putting more land under irrigation, those three things principally. And so it seems to me that we've got a very serious situation facing us in the future, because there's still a limit, although we still can go higher. There's still a limit to what you can do with a plant as far as trapping solar energy and carbon dioxide and water and making plant tissue and food. And so I think that we're really getting to a point now, although because the monsoons have been rather good in Asia lately, we haven't seen it the way we did in 1972, for example. But I just think with the per capita production been going down in Asia since about 1984 or 5, and per capita food grain production, and in Latin America is a similar thing. And then in the 80s, it stopped increasing. And it's going down now. We doubled our production over the 25 year period as far as rice was concerned. I think wheat did even more than that. But those days are over. And people, agriculture economists, for example, say, why don't you produce another IRA and double yields again? You don't do that. That's not the nature of the natural universe.
It isn't that easy, is it?
No.
Matt, what about you? Spent many years in Latin America, and you look at that part of the world with a lot of experience, just like Bob has depicted Asia to us now.
When I sit here and look at you two people and look at what has happened in your lifetimes of working with food production, I think it's truly remarkable. And there have been two big winners, as far as I'm concerned, with modern agriculture as you knew it. First of all, the prices of basic foodstuffs has dropped. The poor consumer basically is really a big winner in the last 30 years. People are eating more calories, they're eating more protein, and this is even more marked at the lower levels. So this is one thing why we can never be complacent about food production. I think it's a very important point. The other big winner, I think, has been the environment. When I talk about the environment, I'm talking about the natural resource space, soils and water. We are, most of the big increases we've got have come from increased yields per hectare, or increased yields per acre. I would say probably about 80% actually worldwide, and about 20% has been due to extra land brought into cultivation. Mm-hmm. So I believe that we have found out most of the good areas. We're farming most of the good areas of the world. Mm-hmm. There are very few corn belts, there are very few pampas, there are very few Punjabs left to farm. And one thing that worries me is how, in the developing world, how little attention we've actually given to that managing that natural resource base. Because basically we're on our last frontier in many senses. We have to build up a scientific base in these developing countries where we know much more about soils, we know much more about water management. And this, I think, is going to be the big challenge for the next era of scientific endeavor in food production.
All right. In the case of water, are you referring to irrigated agriculture or to rain-fed or to both? And if it's both, clarify the difference.
I think it's both. I definitely think that we have a lot to learn about how to manage irrigation schemes. A lot has been learned, but I think there's a lot more expertise that we need to bring to bear. I think the efficiency of irrigation can be improved tremendously. And also in the rain-fed areas. And I would say that, you know, when we talk about natural resources, we're inclined to spend a lot of time thinking about the more fragile areas. But basically, we know very little about the very productive areas.
Maybe we shouldn't be on the fragile areas.
And I don't believe that agriculture has a role in the forest margin or on the hillsides if we are looking for a stable agriculture. And I think we need to spend much more effort and much more time looking at the more productive areas and making sure that they're sustainable in the long run. The Europeans have done this very well in Northern Europe on land that's been very poor. Yeah. The Chinese have done it and have farmed for millennia. It's not that it can't be done, but I think we need to be very careful that we do it in time.
One of the things it seems to me that we need to pay more attention to, particularly in Africa and parts of Latin America, is to find substitute for shifting cultivation. And that, to me, is the most inefficient and destructive way of... It was a viable thing 100 years ago. We had fewer people, and even more recently than that, perhaps. But now it's not only labor-intensive, but as population grows continues to increase, your time of bush fallow just goes down and down, and you just can't support it. You can't restore fertility. And it seems to me we should have a major effort devoted toward finding ways of substituting for shifting cultivation and so that we can go on and produce as much food as we can on the land that's available.
Well, isn't this a choice that, not that it's one or the other, but probably the right mix between the two, but certainly with the emphasis on environmental degradation, to continue to slash and burn and move on.
Can't be done.
But in order to make these farms continue to be productive, we have to have fertility by way of crop rotations insofar as possible, organic use of organic materials, but beyond that, chemical fertilizers. Yeah. Otherwise,
you got to.
They're going to continue to move, and this the world doesn't understand.
Right.
And in this day of great enthusiasm for environmental issues, and Bob, you and I were trained foresters originally. We should know a little about this. It concerns me greatly that the general public is so badly informed about this choice. We've got to provide the inputs that permit sustainability in environments that basically, from a standpoint of both soil and rainfall patterns and temperatures, can be sustainable over time, long time, and not be moving on to these fragile ones and destroying them, and leaving vast sectors of the society out there in poverty and misery, where you can't even afford to transfer food to them in those years when they can't produce enough to survive them.
I think that's a very, very important point. I think the real environmental problems are solved, I think, by increasing agricultural production in the good areas. I think Theodore Schultz many years ago in one of his books, Transforming Traditional Agriculture, made the distinction between land as a natural endowment and land as something, as a factor of production. Well, land as a factor of production basically means land that's invested in. You have applied fertilizer, you're doing the right rotation. I mean, most of the land that is producing well today is land that in its natural state wouldn't produce a quarter of what it's producing.
What about those places like the Cerrado? First, I'm not sure if Bob really understands the term Cerrado that we use in Brazil. And first, give a little feel for this and what's happened. Because to me, this is one area that I thought that I would never see in my lifetime. When I first looked at those soils 45 years ago, and I saw people trying to improve them and people trying to grow crops on them, I used to cry, thinking, in my lifetime, I'll never see something. And what's happening? I think Bob would like to hear some of the things that are happening in this so-called Cerrado area. What is it?
Well, the Cerrado is a vast area in the central part of Brazil. It's basically a savanna.
I know about it, but what I'd like to know is what can you do with it now? What's the modern progress? What have you done in recent years to get this back into production? I remember that it was a very soil, very heavy, high in the iron and aluminum, extremely acid, and many crops couldn't tolerate it. Now what?
Well, first I think in order that we all understand historically the history of these soils and their limitations, and also the benefits from the standpoint of climate, temperatures, and moisture, and topography, and what's been done to put these together into a production package.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Well, first of all, they're, as you said, they're very acid soils, high content of free aluminum, and high content of exchangeable aluminum in the soils. They're quite deep. Physically, they're very good soils. Mm-hmm. They have very good physical structure. They're basically derived from old, very old surface, geological surface, probably one of the oldest in the world. Mm-hmm. And I suppose in some cases linked to parts of Africa when the continental drift, they just broke apart. Mm-hmm. And but these soils basically were soils that were used for very extensive grazing up to about 25 years ago. Very low carrying capacity. Even the vegetation in the Cerrados was very bent and crooked, you know, as a result of the aluminum toxicity in the trees and so forth, the bush that was in there. It was very miserable looking stuff. However, when you went through the Cerrados and you went through a river bottom where you got some organic matter that neutralize the aluminum, you got pretty good, nice stands of timber and so forth. I mean, it was quite obvious that this was a problem. But they got into it about 25 years ago, and they've made a lot of progress, especially in terms of soil fertility and how to manage that soil fertility. They have increased the phosphorus contents. They have done a lot of liming. They have used gypsum along with lime to leach the calcium through the profile, so you get a more effective profile. In the early days when they were doing it, the rooting depths were so shallow that after a 7-day drought, crops like corn and wheat began to wilt, and soybeans. Now they have a much more, in areas that have been farmed for the last 20 years, they have a much more effective rooting depth. So they're basically, you know, large-scale cropping is very, very feasible in the Cerrados today. And they have increased maize production, they have increased soybean production, and they have increased even some wheat production. Wheat, of course, is a dry season crop, so it has to be grown under irrigation where there's water. Mm. And also maybe in the, what they call the várzeas, in the river banks along the in the lower areas. But they've made a lot of progress, I think, in the genetics of looking for aluminum tolerance, and they've made a tremendous amount of progress in the soil fertility management issues.
Roughly what do you have to apply for to grow a crop of maize, for example, on that type of soil today, after you've gotten some of this soluble aluminum and iron lower, so you can grow crops? What do you have to do for annual maintenance?
Annual maintenance, you're basically talking about 120 to 150 kilos of nitrogen.
Yeah.
You're talking about 160 kilos of phosphorus still, although the phosphorus levels are building up over time, so phosphorus is becoming less a critical problem with time. And they're basically the, and of course the periodic liming has to go on.
But your cation exchange capacity is pretty low, isn't it?
The cation exchange capacity is low.
Yes, I would think it would be that kind of a clay.
That's right, and they've had some problems with magnesium problems as well.
And some minor elements.
And some minor elements deficiencies
boron,
in some parts.
For example, zinc.
Zinc is a problem in some cases.
In some places, sulfur.
Yes. Yes.
Of course, it's a minor element, but nevertheless.
Right. But one thing that I noticed over time as well was when we went there first to look at wheat, even under irrigation, we were getting no more than 3.5 tons. And now, you know, with the improvement in the soil fertility, they're now getting wheat, you know, of 7.5 tons, because it's a very...
That's high yields.
They're high yields because irrigation. Under irrigation, but because it's a very dry climate in the winter, so disease levels are extremely... and disease is very low. So you know, that is one of the frontiers, I think, that will be explored in the future, and they are doing it.
And, Bob would probably like to know also how this has been put together in minimum tillage, and utilizing the organic matter. Some of this is rolling land, how that fits in, and rotations from the standpoint of disease.
Yes, they haven't done that much on rotations because they basically have very few alternatives yet. I think they're basically stuck with maize and soybeans as their main crops for the summertime. The minimum tillage, of course, is something that has increased tremendously in Brazil because these soils are very erodible, and since it is a summer monsoon season, basically that they get, you get lots of erosion on these soils. So they've gone into minimum tillage, and one of the things, of course, with minimum tillage is that as you build up the organic matter, you get less free aluminum in solution. So that's even a liming effect over time.
Yep.
And that looks very
to get the extra organic matter, are you using green manure crops, or are you plowing under crop residues, lastly, or what system do you use to increase organic matter?
They're basically incorporating the residues of the crops
mostly left on the surface.
Mostly left on the surface.
As it decomposes gradually, it's worked in. Am I right?
Right.
And one of the interesting things, Bob, for example, in the case of wheat, and to a lesser extent in corn, and this is going on in rice too, we had a shuttle program. The original breeders in Brazil had relatively good tolerance to aluminum in their old wheat varieties, but they were miserable from the standpoint of agronomy and yield potential. When we grew our Mexican dwarf wheats in those same soils, they would die. They wouldn't yield hardly anything. But when these were crossed, and then we started shuttle breeding, and Eva Viegas, our biochemist, whom you both know, had a screening test, so she could grow the F2s in big numbers and pick out the ones where the roots weren't affected. We used to grow them at 45 parts per million of soluble aluminum just for about 18, 24 hours, and examine them, stain the roots and the ones that were brown and dead, and then you would put the trays with all of these seedlings in water for 2 days, nutrients, and see which ones regrew the tips of the roots. and put those that did in the greenhouse and grew the seed, and then divided it. Part went to Brazil, part to Sonora in the alkaline soils, and shipped them back and forth, the best, and suddenly you had these things. And in corn, they've got a good screening technique. Now, some of those new hybrids will yield 6-7 tons under rainfall conditions with that practice that you're talking about in Brazil. Fantastic.
Now, this tolerance to aluminum that you had built in genetically, does that do the fact it isn't absorbed, or what is the physiological factor that makes them tolerant?
It looks like that it's absorbed. It looks like that the plant just can metabolize the aluminum much more efficiently than the non-tolerant ones. And of course, it all has to do with the root growth. Basically, root growth is totally limited by aluminum.
These soils, you don't have laterite farming underneath them.
No, you don't have. They're not laterite soils.
Yeah.
I would say, you know, and there are some estimates now over Brazil that there's very little lateritic soil in Brazil. What we would classify as very lateritic.
Well, this is a problem we have in parts of Africa, Sierra Leone, parts of Liberia, and some of these other countries. The old soils have been there forever in the high rainfall areas, and you get this impervious layer down below.
Yeah, but these don't have that.
They're structurally there.
But this is a limiting factor in the development of those regions agriculturally.
So I had occasion to try to get the history just about 2 weeks ago. I called Hartwig, the breeder of the soybeans for the southern part of the U.S., who originally, after he finished his graduate school in Minnesota, went to North Carolina, and he worked there for a number of years. And I said, where did you find the aluminum tolerance in these things? Because most of the Brazilians, in one way or another, both true students of his who come to study in Mississippi with him, and took back materials, traced back to where? I said, where did you get this? And he said, when I was in North Carolina, at some of the outlying stations up in the what do you call it?
The Piedmont.
Piedmont.
Yeah.
He said, some of them were out, good up there, and so I took them down in my Mississippi program and started them, and then eventually we found that some of them did very well in Brazil, and here we go, step by step. And this is fascinating how these things pay off a long distance from where they were originally used. They were important in the Piedmont, but they weren't important down in the Delta along the Mississippi.
Right.
But the genes were carried there in a mask on unexpressed form and indirectly moved in through testing into Brazil.
And we're the basis of a very big soybean industry in Brazil.
Sure. It's amazing. One thing that the Brazilians missed on, Bob, the triticales, when they were tested in Brazil, were in the early times, 20 years ago, were so much better than the wheats.
Yeah.
But no one had the courage to try to make this a commercial grain crop. And now you see that window is getting pretty close because the wheats are getting the tolerance, and so it's easier to go the wheat route. They should have gone the triticale route 20 years ago.
It's interesting that triticale didn't, although all the early work have done to show its superiority in many respects, that it hasn't developed more than it has.
In Poland, it's about the only place where it's playing an important role. And there it's on problem soils, where the only crop that wheat did poorly on these soils, these sandy soils, acid soil. And so rye was grown. But rye is okay for a certain amount of bread, but from the feeding of livestock, it's got problems in nutrition. Yeah. And triticale doesn't have this and can be grown and will compete or outperform rye on those problem soils.
I thought I read somewhere that in Spain, the triticale is being used to some extent.
Well, it's being grown some in Spain, Portugal more, but in parts of North Africa, in Tunisia, it's finding a niche. Mm-hmm. But it needed a little more aggressive push in Brazil. That's where the window was wide open 20 years ago.
Right.
The grain used to be a great handicap. Mm-hmm. Low test weight, low flour yield. But I'm talking about it for feed grain. It should have been pushed.
Right, right. Now, you know, we've talked for the last 20 minutes about the technical side of it. What are the other factors that you see, for example, in Africa as you, and in Asia as well, that, you know, blocks the way in terms of getting higher productivity from the land? And
well, Bob, you take a whack at this first.
Well, of course, as I said earlier, I feel that the main things that you can do are to continue to work on varietal improvement for whatever you need for the environments that you're working with, and you need to use more fertilizer without any question, and when to put as much land on.
You're talking specifically about Africa now, or no, what part of the world?
This is true. I wasn't talking specifically about Africa. Did you want me to speak about?
No, but I wasn't clear to me you were talking about in general.
And, but to me, these are the important. I don't think it makes too much difference what you're talking about, except that in Africa you still have a chance to expand an area that you don't have in Asia, because much of the good land has already been used. And so you've got more opportunity in Africa, but you also have, in these hilly soils, highly erodible and so forth, in Africa you've got some real problems of management as you get into the poorer land. So I agree with you in your earlier statement that the concentrate on the good soils is just as long as they are available, you can do something with it. It's like when people are endowing universities, they give more to Harvard University than they do at the University of New Hampshire, for example, where I used to be, because they feel that they, even though they've got more endowment already, but by far, they still think that's where they can make the best use of it. I think we're going to have to pretty soon get into this matter of capital and money availability.
Yeah. Before we do that, could I just ask a couple of questions about the African situation? Where the big problem is going to be in the next 20 or 30 years, as I perceive it. Mm-hmm. Back in the 60s and 70s, it was Asia, before the breakthrough mm-hmm. in rice and wheat, both in India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and China. But it would appear to me that the problems for the next two or three decades, the worst in the world is going to be Africa. How do you people look at this?
That's it, but in the long run, we get problems in Asia too. But I think for immediate now that the room for improvement exists and where it's very much needed is Africa, without any question. And as we have said to each other at various times, to me, education of women, and
education at what level?
Well, they have to start. They have to begin in first grade.
Okay.
Well, through, go as far as you can, of course. And so
the whole primary and secondary school.
Right. Well, yes, you can't start in with high school or college. You have to go through the whole
business. Isn't it true that, good Sheriff, the emphasis on education is at the university level in Africa?
The thing is, in my opinion, I'm not as well acquainted with the higher institutes of higher education in Africa as I should be.
Some of them are pretty elite.
But it seems to me that they're turning out too many technically trained, I would say too many, but the people are such a large proportion of them are trained in the fundamental sciences, but they don't have the feeling for the land, or they have the understanding of practical agriculture and of what the farmer really needs. The problems that he's struggling with are completely different with the problems that this is scientist is. Well, it probably is in part is due to the structure of the university, also part due to the fact that the people feel that the farming has a very low level of priority and prestige. People just think that that's just about the beginning of things, and very, very primitive. That's they don't want to be associated with that.
But that's where 85% of the people are,
But they don't have that feeling of service to the people. They think about me, myself, what is my reputation going to be? I want to be a lawyer, I want to be a doctor, I want to be
Let me see if I understand this. That attitude, the poor primary and secondary schools, doesn't permit the youth from 80% of the total population of youth from the countryside to ever gain entrance to the university. They can't get in academically.
Yeah.
And the ones, mostly, with few exceptions, who study agriculture, probably do it as a third or fourth choice.
Mm.
They wanted to get into medicine or engineering or chemistry or economics. But they didn't make it there, so they're in agriculture. They have no background in agriculture. They get a good theoretical training. And then what you said, they don't know how to apply it. Is that that right? Is that the cause and effect?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that I agree with Bob in this thing about education. I don't think you can make a better investment in a rural community than in education, and especially I think it's now proven very strongly that the education of women is pivotal, because that affects all family life, all aspects of family life. It affects health and it affects the continuing education and so forth. I think the other problem we have, we're seeing it all over the developing world, is that the agenda for investment is fixed by the city's elite, and the rural areas are totally neglected, and I don't think we're getting the investments that we need in rural education, in rural infrastructure.
What infrastructure, for example?
Roads, bridges, even ports to export their produce or import whatever they need for production. But I think that this is a real problem. I think that we're going to face, because we still have a big rural poor. But we have this big urban population that also has to be dealt with, and who sets basically the investment agenda of the government?
The whole policy. Political policies.
And I think it's very difficult to find policymakers in urban areas that actually know the rural communities and know what the rural problems are. So therefore, they're swept under the carpet. They're neglected.
Sure.
And. I think we need to revisit this whole thing of what sort of investments they need to do in rural areas.
Also, in getting teachers for the, suppose you triple the schools in Senegal, for example, brother, with only 10% of the people are literate today. If you triple that number, you've got to find the teachers who are willing to go into rural areas.
That willing is a key word.
Yes, right.
The conditions are so miserable.
I know.
And the salary is so bad. Why should they leave the cities to go back there?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, I think the salaries are the main problem. I think we're even seeing this in extension in developing. Well, you know, it's very hard to get extensionists actually to live in rural communities.
Yeah.
They mostly live in the state capitals.
Well, they need it in the rural areas.
And they need to be out there with the farmers. Mm. They need to.
And the extension people, so-called, are so poorly trained at the present time.
Mm.
In our little modest corn and sorghum programs, they're extension, not research, mostly in Africa, because we saw data when we started this with Japanese funding, the Sasakawa funding, that there was quite a bit of data, improved varieties of seed, quite a bit of knowledge on what fertilizers and dates of rates of planting and weed control, but nothing was going to the farm.
No.
For the simple reason that the extension people had no funds, they had never been trained, they didn't know about these things in the research stations, they had no way of getting out there. And so a simple approach with some bicycles and just working within the extension service to improve and first to train those people in the package of technology that you were trying to move to farms. And they suddenly start getting some shine in their eyes and get enthusiastic. They've got something that the farmer doesn't know about, and they feel useful, and it changes attitudes also. You've seen it, Matt, in Latin America, we went through this. But it's more pronounced and evident in Africa, where the situation is much worse.
To what extent do you think that rural credit is a limiting factor? In
the rural what?
Credit.
Matt, you answered that. It's, of course, vital, but you know.
Yeah, I think that, we're basically, when we're talking here about how to get things done and how to improve productivity and how to improve production and make food cheaper, I think we're talking about a big upfront investment. I mean, these things cost money.
Are you acquainted with what the Grameen Bank has been doing in Bangladesh, for example?
That's an interesting story. Yeah. I'd like to hear that.
Well, I don't know the details. I'm not an economist and so forth, but I find that they have, even people with not any real capital or anything to really to base a yield on as an American bank would do. They say, what have you got for collateral? They don't have any. But they do it on their personality and their ambition and willingness to try and all that kind of stuff. And they've done them quite a job.
Oh, it's amazing. I've read about it, but I've never seen it. But I'm impressed by what I read. Yeah,
right. Yes. Yes.
You know.
I don't know it. I don't know the system.
Yeah.
And I've heard about it, and yeah. I think people have tried to copy it.
Of course, Bangladesh is, some people say, just a basket case. Well, it's not quite that bad, but almost.
It's made a lot of progress, but the population overwhelms them.
From the almond crop to the boro crop, and increase the boro crop, the winter dry season crop. And that has really done something for Bangladesh. In fact, they say it saved the situation for the farmers.
Well,
rice
it's
is concerned.
Pretty hard to rice control any input when the root of the thing you planted is 2.5 feet or 3 feet under the water when you're trying to harvest the damn thing. Right, it's tough this, goal.
Yes.
Yeah. Deep water rice has been one of the things they have, but the yields are always low. Agriculture economists and agronomists getting together have. Now they say when you get two metric tons per hectare out of deep water rice, you're doing well. And you don't have the chance to go up to 5 to 10 metric tons per hectare, which you can do on good upland
soils.
But then you're a victim of the flood stage too. If the water is normal, it's one thing. Those varieties, you may get 2 tons. Yeah. But if the flood period is higher than normal, what do you get? You get people diving out of the down to harvest this thing below water, pulling it up and cutting it off. It's awful.
Awful. It is awful. Well, that's my last consulting job at Bangladesh, and I was 82 years old. And I was really, really discouraged. I went down into this city, in Dhaka, and no stout people except a few merchants and so forth. But everybody is undernourished, and poverty everywhere. Whether it's rural areas or urban areas, you've got poverty all over the place, and the population going ahead still at about 2.2% or something like that, 2.3, and it's just a very
when you say that Bangladesh is a basket case. You know, it's been a basket case now for 25 years.
Yeah.
And it's amazing that's all it is, because keep up with the population growth they've had has been,
if you look
been
at
an
the,
achievement, no?
I'm quite sure I'm right about this, that every major development project in Bangladesh has been financed by outside funds, not from
yes.
their own.
Yes, yes, you're right.
No, so it's foreign aid that's kept them going. That's what
you're
I
right.
called about.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah. Even though there's been considerable increase in productivity of their agriculture and total production, it's coming from other sources than within the country.
That's right.
Skimmed around. We talked a bit about credit. We didn't talk much about inputs for Africa.
Yeah.
Let's say for the next 10. And what about this whole pricing situation? Are the prices that are being paid to the local subsistence farmers adequate to stimulate and permit the adoption of that new technology if it's got the ability to double or triple the yield compared to the traditional?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, we are faced, like I said earlier on, you know, the probably the biggest winner in all this has been the poor consumer, because sure, food prices have gone down. So, you know, then the subsistence farmer, not the subsistence farmer, because the subsistence farmer probably gains from that, because most of his he gets most of his, or spends most of what he has on food. But the farmer that's trying to make it out of subsistence has a real problem, in the sense that, you know, he is in a world where real prices are falling. And, you know, he's, you know, I don't see any change in that. I see prices actually going down if we maintain the rhythm of productivity that we've had with the last 25 years.
But what you're really implying, mm-hmm, is that we've got big surpluses in the Americas, both Canada and USA,
sure,
in Western Europe.
Sure.
But if you look behind the scenes, these are in a different way subsidized.
Mm-hmm.
And yet these surpluses, we are trying to market overseas, and it's been going from bad to worse in some cases, so that you even subsidize the export to get rid of this. And do we expect the third world farmer to compete with this? Do we expect the political leader in Africa, if this is given at these very low and favorable rates, not to be tempted to take this apple of temptation, this subsidized grain that they offered to him in big quantities?
That keeps the urban population happy.
Right. Yep. And this political, you know, this is leader a, in place. Mm-hmm. What's to be done about this?
That's a catch-22 situation, isn't it? I mean, if I were a political leader in Africa, I'd take cheap food too. That is a real problem, because again, you know, we're seeing that policy is being set by the realities of urban life, I think.
Do we sit on this lid until the world explodes? Remember, the percentage of that population and the population growth that's building, sooner or later it will explode against the urban populations of those countries, where you get this big spread. This seems to me. How do you colleagues look at this?
I look at it as being a future disaster myself. I'm not over pessimistic, but I just can't see how the world can continue to add anywhere from 80 to 100 million people a year and go in it year after year for the next 20, 30, 40 years and still have any decent standard of living in these countries. I think you're going back to, more likely, as I started to say before, I think that Lester Brown called it the demographic trap that they're into, that they're going to be back where we were in the 1700s, where birth and death rates were very similar. And so your population is going to be controlled that way. Perhaps AIDS is going to take care of it in Africa, I don't know. It could be like that. But anyway, I don't think it could be done by family planning unless they make much better progress than they've been making in recent years, even though we have some bright spots.
But if you make the assumption that AIDS might do it, at what misery will this take place? Because when this population is being reduced, what percentage of those people can't even work because they're physically debilitated beyond the point where they can work?
Mm. Yeah, I suppose controlling, going back to how it was controlled historically, basically was through disease. Mm. And I suppose that's an unacceptable solution for us today. I think this whole thing of food production, you know, there is such a thing as the food equation. You know, when the population rises, you just have to have more food, and I think we're getting more and more out of line probably as time goes on.
I remember a man by the name of, I'm forgetting his last name now, I was calling somebody in Australia, and he said, "Oh, don't worry about it." He said, "Food and people go together. If you've got food, you've got people. If you don't have food, you don't have people."
But you have explosive things that we call war. When misery gets too great, it starts in a local civil war, and it has, it's like an infectious disease. It crosses frontiers, and soon half the world is involved. that's been made.
I suppose I'm a bit more optimistic about the population control thing. I think we've seen
Are
some.
Are you talking about control or education or?
Well, control in general terms. Again, you know, we go back to the education of rural women. I think this is a very important in terms of getting population under control.
I think we've got to say that it's been a very nice conversation here, but and we could go on forever on these problems, but I think we have to say that it's been a pleasure talking with you. And with you,
Sam,
man,
here. It's very nice.
And I've enjoyed it very much, and I hope sometime we can get together again.
How many man-years is our collective experience in third world developing agriculture? Have you any idea?
Well,
how many years?
Say this again. I'm going off.
If we added up the collective numbers of years of experience, how many do you have in foreign agriculture?
In international agriculture, really, I didn't begin until 1954, so that's roughly 40 years ago.
And you're 50.
I mean, 50 this year. 50th year now.
43 you went to Mexico, no?
44. I just started my 50th year, the 1st of October. And you?
Okay. 20.
Yeah. So 20, 40, 44 did you say?
I said
64, 40. 50, 110. About 110 man years of experience in developing nations agriculture
problems.
we see more problems than the permanent solutions.